Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Data drives decision-making in many fields, but especially in education. It measures student achievement. It calculates who gets money and how much. It powers policy decisions, like what's working and what's not. But what happens when the data is no longer available or harder to come by? This is one of the concerns being raised by our first guest today, Ohio State Professor Josh Hawley. He directs the Ohio Education Research Center and teaches classes in public policy and data science. Welcome to All Sides, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
So President Trump, in March, signed an executive order dismantling the U.S. Department of Education. And in recent weeks, the department has cut its staff roughly in half. 600 chose to leave on their own. More than 1,300 were laid off. And among some of those employees, they work for the National Center of Educational Statistics. It's a small but vital office. Can you tell us what that center does? And then we'll talk about how the changes will affect the operations of that area.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So NCES is one of 13 principal statistical agencies for the federal government, and it has a budget of about $370 million and a little bit over 100 direct employees prior to the cuts. It's responsible statutorily, like other federal statistical agencies are, for the collection of data on education, higher education, child care, longitudinal studies, and working with states on something called the State Longitudinal Data System Program, and international surveys, which is a very small part of its operations. The NCES historically has operated a couple of central repositories for state data or institutional data, because a lot of the data doesn't come from the state education and workforce department here. It would come directly from the schools or the higher education institutions themselves. So those are two systems called the Common Core of Data for K through 12 data and the Integrated Post-Secondary Education Data System, which is the one for higher education.
So collecting all this information, did Congress tell them to do that, or is that something the department does on their own?
For the most part, they have statutory kind of obligations that underlie a lot of these core data collection efforts. Some of them came up as a result of priorities of particular administrations. So there's one called the College Scorecard, which deals with kind of comparison shopping, so to speak, on the kind of inputs and outputs of higher education. And that is a kind of a parallel project between education and Social Security, and involves a really unique kind of display of information that consumers and their families can use to assess the kind of payoff of particular degree programs.
So you direct what is called the Ohio Education Research Center.
Correct.
And you were telling me before we started, you've been there for how long?
I've been at OSU 25 years.
25 years. So you spent a lot of time digging into a lot of data. Are you worried now that this data is not going to come to you? It's going to be changed significantly? It's going to basically mess up some of your research?
Some of the tools that we build for the state of Ohio are at risk given the decisions that the Trump administration made regarding NCES. So, for example, the IPEDS data system, the post-secondary data system, is currently, institutions are currently submitting data right now, and we've heard reports that the systems have been down periodically. They've not been staffed to respond to queries when institutions have run into problems uploading individual files. And we rely on those data consistently to do comparisons that the governor's office or Job and Family Services or higher ed or education and workforce ask us to do. And so we need the access to those data as pretty much every other research institution would.
So I'm going to make up an example. So if the governor said, I want to know how many students in Ohio high schools are studying STEM fields, you could look that up, right? Yeah.
That's a difficult example, but
did I pick a wrong? Okay, why don't you tell me an example?
Yeah. Ask the example about higher ed, and that would be related to the post-secondary data system. the high school system is a little bit different. The Common Core of Data has that. Mm-hmm. And both of those staff were basically let go. So the staff that operate those systems.
So does the state of Ohio collect information and then report that to the U.S. Department of Education? Is that how it worked in the past?
In some systems it does. In the higher education system, because higher education institutions are independent and largely report directly into IPEDS, on the K-12 side, it depends on the data that's being collected. So, for example, NAEP, which is the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the nation's report card, that's a kind of survey that's administered in an assessment that's given by an outside vendor, ETS, the Education Testing Service. And that is then institutions are selected at the school district level, and then they're administered the survey, and then the data come back to NCES. So most of the operations are actually happening by school districts, and they then roll up to the federal government.
And would you say that the Department of Education maybe contracts with different places to help them with the data and collecting it? So do you think that that's the way it might continue? Where they could still, even if there's like only two employees left in the Department of Education, they could hire a contractor to do some of this work?
Well, they got rid of pretty much all of the contracts for contractors prior to the executive order on the stand down of the department. So the reality is, even though the majority of the funding was allocated to pay for private contractors, the way it's plays out in the future, it would be hard for me to imagine that those individuals who were let go from the private companies like Westat or APT or RTI or NORC or others would be available to come back quickly, many of them would move on to other careers.
In what ways does your group collaborate with the state of Ohio when it comes to policies or ways to improve the education of children across the state? I mean, this is what you're doing. You're the Ohio Education the Ohio Education Research Center. How do you collaborate with the state?
So the Ohio Education Research Center is a collaborative with six state agencies and Ohio State. It started back in 2011, 2012. And we do a kind of a biennial agreement with the state government to provide certain services that the agencies or the governor's office want that deal with Ohio education data and workforce data. We also have some kind of services that we provide for disability services organizations at the state level, Ohio Opportunities for Ohioans with Disabilities, and developmental disabilities, and then the Housing Association.
Do you feel like going forward, some of these things that you collaborate on are going to change dramatically?
Well, I think there's two realities. One is that the direct impact of closing down some of the federal systems kind of brings us back to a earlier era of administration of pretty much anything. It's kind of like if you got rid of all the guidance for medicine, how would doctors practice? They would just have their own kind of intuition, their own data. I mean, to a certain extent, in education research, we rely on the federal government to set there was a thing called the What Works Clearinghouse, which is kind of sets the parameters for teachers, how they're supposed to teach certain things, what the quality is. If we no longer have those, we're back to being kind of doctors with practicing based on our own knowledge. And so we'll do that more. We're pretty skilled. We have good contacts with other researchers and other institutions, and we'll make the best with what's available. But I think the other implication is that the legislature and the governor's office would like to do more to staff the workforce with individuals who are highly skilled. Mm-hmm. And to do that, you need data and information on the educational performance, the workforce transitions, what are we doing for all the unemployed workers who are losing their jobs, how are we retraining them. Those are all active questions that you need a research partnership to answer, and that's kind of what we do. So I don't fear for that, but I think it's going to be made much harder without the federal system in place.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how changes at the federal level will impact education policy. With us is Ohio State Professor Josh Hawley. He directs the university's Ohio Education Research Center. The Trump administration has stated that its goal is to give more power to states. But does the Ohio Department of Education and Workforce have the ability to take on these additional tasks? Do you think that they can come up with some of this data for you?
The Ohio Department of Education and Workforce and the Higher Education Office have very good staff. They have good research offices. We have very strong partnerships with. There are some areas that nobody will be able to substitute. So, for example, there's an area of educational research that's called psychometrics. It deals with test and measurement. So it's like, you know, measuring literacy kind of proficiency. Those kinds of skills are really difficult to hire for at the local state level. They tend to be concentrated federally or in contractors that the federal government was using. And so any of the testing issues would, I think, be very hard for a State Department to substitute for the federal or the state partnership roles. So it may necessitate that Ohio engage in more kind of state-to-state partnerships to kind of find those staff that they'll need.
And, I mean, we do a lot of state-to-state comparisons, but if each state is collecting data in a different way, we will no longer be comparing apples to apples.
Right. And a couple of the programs that the federal government eliminated contracts for, one is the Common Education Data Standard, which is what it sounds like. Mm-hmm. It's the data standard. And the other kind of is the wage record interchange system. And these are acronyms that mean nothing to the listeners, but believe me, they're a big deal in my world where we're kind of eliminating the standards and the data systems that we rely on to match data across states in order to produce those kind of benchmark comparisons.
Now, the Trump administration is saying that they're doing this because there's just too much bloat in the federal government. The Department of Education was too big, doing too many things, too much money. So getting rid of all this and going back to, as you said, you know, I guess teachers and administrators just using their gut to figure out what to do next. Some could say that that's a good way to go.
Right. There is a valid point always about bloat. And I am in a College of Public Affairs, Public Administration. I do not dispute the fact that there's bloat in every layer of government that needs to be cut. I will say that the budget for NCES was no more than $370 million. If you compare that to, say, the Title I budget, $16 billion.
Billion, yeah.
I mean, it's like, you know, what are we cutting here that, you know, is creating more trouble for the system? Mm-hmm. And, you know, back when Paul Ryan was leading Congress and we had the evidence, had something called the Evidence-Based Policy Act, there was a lot of bipartisan support for data and accountability. And I really hate to see that go by the wayside because I think both sides of Congress were strongly committed to statistical standards, to common data systems, to education workforce data matches, and had created kind of not only new legislation, but new programs like the State Longitudinal Data System. There's one on the workforce guide called the Workforce Data Quality Initiative. And all those programs provided a kind of basically the Eisenhower pathway for, you know, for research data. And you need those systems in place for states to kind of improve their performance at a high level and to know that they're improving relative to other states.
Now, saying that, a lot of people argue that the nation's schools are not living up to their potential. I mean, we have all this data,
yeah,
and it's not helping. So What would you say to that? I mean, you analyze the data, you don't fix the policy. So
right,
yeah,
I would argue you don't blame the you know, the tape measure when you measure a board wrong to cut it, right? you blame the person who used the tape measure. You know, getting rid of the tests for education because you don't like the results makes no sense in that respect.
All right. Well, I guess we will have to just wait and see where it goes, though, right? Because at this point, you know that the department and some of the contracts have been eliminated, but you don't know what'll happen next.
Correct. We will have to wait and see. I think there are some opportunities to maintain some of the programs in different ways, maybe more efficient ways. And I hope they figure it out that way, because we would really be a poorer country if we didn't have the statistical data systems in education. And I think schools and students and teachers would be worse off for it.
That was Ohio State Professor Josh Hawley. He directs the university's Ohio Education Research Center. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Coming up, we're going to talk with an education policy expert from the Fordham Institute on changes that they want to see at the K-12 level. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Just like data drives policy decisions, it also factors heavily into funding calculations. They go hand in hand. Ohio lawmakers are debating Governor DeWine's proposed budget right now. It includes $8.1 billion for K-12 spending. But the House on Tuesday favored a slightly different funding solution. Education ranks as Ohio's second largest expense behind Medicaid. One of the pressing issues is how to balance quality with value for Ohio's 1.6 million public school students. Joining us now is Chad Aldis, Vice President of Ohio Policy for the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, a nonprofit conservative think tank. Thanks for joining us on All Sides, Chad.
It's my pleasure. Glad to be here.
Sorry, your institute had lots of words. I got mixed up there. I got it. So the Ohio House yesterday unveiled an education plan that is different from what Governor DeWine wanted. Under this plan, House leaders put $226 billion toward K-12 schools, more than in DeWine's plan. But that number is still far below what was called for in the final 2 years of what is being called the Fair School Funding Plan. That's the bipartisan six-year proposal that was passed in 2021. So House Speaker Matt Huffman has in the past called the Fair School Funding Plan unsustainable. So do you feel like this budget proposal that the House came out with is reflecting his opinion?
I think it very much is. Mm-hmm. And I think in this case, the speaker is correct. The way the structure of the Cupp-Patterson school funding formula was implemented, it is unsustainable long term. And it's really for a very simple reason. Mm-hmm. We've calculated the cost of education in the formula, and then there are dollars that go into the formula outside of that. So whether it's federal dollars or it's local optional taxes above and beyond what we say it costs to educate a student, mm-hmm. and those increase the costs and they increase teacher salaries, which is a good thing, increasing teacher salaries. But then 2 years later, they come back to the legislature and say salaries are higher, so you need to increase the state contribution. And mm-hmm. so it's creating a vicious cycle that over the long term, as the speaker has indicated, would be unsustainable.
Now, the governor's plan and the House plan that was unveiled yesterday, both of them are far below the Fair School Funding Plan. the schools are saying that they are just having a hard time because they feel like it is the governor's office and now the House going back on a promise that was made 6 years ago to, or for the 6 year plan. Do you feel like they're going back on a promise?
I do not. This debate was very contentious as it went. There was even language that passed in both budgets that said, we're going to come back and revisit this in 2 years. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't sound like the kind of promises I'm used to getting. Mm-hmm. Now, I understand the frustration. There were some strategic things the Cupp-Patterson advocates did that are now coming back to cause problems. One of the things we've seen is a huge increase in local property values. And what that has done, by the way the school funding formula works, is it means the state contributes less. Mm-hmm. And they were actually asked while trying to pass the legislation, are you sure you want to do that? And they said yes. And now we've seen incredible property appreciation all around the state. And that has resulted in lower state funding, even though, by the way, we're spending more than we ever have on education, more than $16,000 per pupil last year.
But that leads me into my next question, because the numbers that were used in the governor's budget relied on the cost for educating a child. They use numbers from 2022 instead of updating that for 2024. I mean, in those 2 years, we've had a lot of inflation. Everything is more expensive. So therefore, the cost of educating a child would be more. So that's a part of the discrepancy is like, yes, property taxes are more, but also the cost of educating a child is more.
Yeah, the cost does continue to go up. And but the cost of every program the state funds continues to go up. But what they do with Medicaid is they don't sit and say, how much did you spend last year? Let's increase you by X percent. They determine what the value is, what the true cost is. They try to control costs in certain areas. What we've had is, and that goes back to my initial point related to school teacher salaries and the input costs. The input costs have gone up faster than inflation. And that's been the challenge. One of the things we have to remember is in the last 4 years, we've increased public school funding by more than $1.5 billion with a B. That's a lot of money. And that's great because our kids deserve it. And we deserve to have great, well-funded schools. We have that, though. And so the idea that they're going back on a promise when they're proposing a budget that has never funded education at a higher level than it will be next year is a bit of a stretch.
The other side would say that education has never been fully funded. So even if, you know, you're saying that the number is increasing and it's never been more, but it has never been enough.
I think to some, it will never be enough. Mm-hmm. And I certainly understand that perspective. It is an incredible public good that we all benefit from having great schools. That being said, the DeRolf case is now more than 20 years ago that said Ohio's school funding system was unconstitutional. By my count, it's 4 or 5 school funding systems ago. And if advocates believe the current school funding system is unconstitutional, they have an option. They can sue. They haven't, which is a pretty good indicator to me that they're not maybe as sure as their talking points would suggest that the school funding system is unconstitutional.
Now, whenever I was thinking about doing this show related more to education policy, I was thinking about it from the aspect of dismantling the U.S. Department of Education, which is going to change funding for each individual school district. I mean, every school district gets a certain amount of money from the U.S. Department of Education. So what do you think that this change at the federal level is going to mean on the ground for school districts?
That's a really, really important question. We're all going to sort of learn that as we go. There's going to be a lot of responsibility put on Governor DeWine and Director Dakin, the Director of Education, to make sure that the dollars continue to go, the targeted federal dollars for students with special needs, for our most economically disadvantaged students, continue to get distributed in a very thoughtful, smart way, so the dollars go where they're needed most.
So you're saying you think the dollars are still going to come?
The dollars will still come.
Okay.
I think it's very unlikely we see cuts to Title I funding for low-income students or IDEA for students with disabilities. Those dollars will most likely be block granted, which will give states flexibility. And it's important that Ohio's leaders, their feet are held to the fire, and they can continue to distribute those dollars in a way that'll be most helpful to students.
Now, the Fordham Institute just came out with the latest edition of its Ohio Education by the Numbers book for 2025. It provides a lot of demographic and academic breakdowns, math and reading, the number of students who are homeschooled versus in public schools, all of those numbers. Now, numbers and graphs and charts don't work well on the radio. I looked through the book, but you've been looking at Ohio education numbers for a long time. What stood out for you in particular in this year, in your 2025 analysis?
You know, I think probably the NAEP scores.
What's NAEP?
Yeah, thank you. The NAEP is the nation's report card, mm-hmm. and you just had a nice segment on testing. It is a test that's a sample of students in every single U.S. state takes, and it's a way every 2 years to gauge our progress in fourth grade reading and math and compare ourselves to other states. And Ohio, despite some of our investments and some of our efforts, is sort of just muddling along. And we have not fully recovered from the pandemic in either math or reading. And so there's a lot of work to go. And this was a not only a reinforcement of just how much progress we still need to make and how we need to continue to improve education so all our students can reach their potential, but also the fact that the achievement gaps between various student groups continue to be large, some as large as they've ever been.
So, when you compare to other states, Ohio ranks somewhere between 12th and 15th in most of your grading criteria. That's not horrible, right? There's 50 states, so ranking between 12th and 15th, it's not horrible, could be better. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And I think, as Ohio policymakers need to focus on ensuring every student is getting the supports they need to be successful. That means a good school funding system. That means a great distribution of the federal funds that we talked about when they come to the state. It means strong education policies. And right now, the state budget, in addition to school funding, is going to be covering a lot of state policies that could really help students. And the decisions over the next few months are going to be really important for Ohio's future.
But if it's important to your organization and to the governor's office to get higher than that 12th or 15th ranking to make up these things, isn't more funding or following through on the Fair School Funding Plan, isn't that the way to go?
Well, it would be if funding alone improved our schools and got us all the outcomes, we'd all be there. And there's a lot of states that we're ahead of that fund more than us. And there are some states that fund a lot less than us, like the state of Mississippi, that we trail in virtually every category. So we need strong policies in addition to fairly funded schools. And we've been spending a lot of time on the funding, and now we do need to get the policy right.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about education policy in light of changes at the Federal Department of Education. We're also talking about state education policy with Chad Aldis, Vice President for Ohio Policy with the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. So, from looking at all your charts that you've published, you just mentioned that poverty is an underlying factor when it comes to poor performance, achievement, graduation rates. So if money's not the remedy to that, then what's the remedy?
Well, I think money, when it's targeted for our students most in need, can be very, very important. It is a critical factor. And I'll give you an example from this year's budget, something that's being debated. We currently have our school funding system in the Cupp-Patterson school funding mm-hmm. formula funds based on a student's free and reduced price lunch status, which that makes sense to most people. But about 10 years ago, we created this federal lunch program, which is fantastic. It gives a lot more kids free lunch. But we are now funding we're providing free meals to a lot of districts, the entire school district, which means they're all being counted as low income. They're all being counted as getting free and reduced price lunch. What that has had is right now around 41% of Ohio students are actually low income, but our school funding formula says 60% are. So what that has resulted in is sending more money to wealthier districts for low-income students when they're not low-income. And conversely, we're actually going to be in this budget reducing dollars that go to our neediest students. And that is so we need to make sure we get the details right so we can send the money that's necessary to students who are most disadvantaged.
So do you disagree with some school districts having free lunches?
No. You see, this is the thing. It's not about the free lunches. It's mm-hmm. fantastic. If the federal government wants to pay for free lunches, school districts should absolutely serve them. Mm-hmm. And that's. But the question is, if a district is 50% low income, which is great, let's give all the kids free lunches, but we shouldn't fund the students in the school funding formula, the 50% who aren't low income, we shouldn't give those students the bump. And that's what our current school funding system is doing. We need to increase the amount we're giving for the students who are low income. Because when a district is truly 90% low income, they are actually getting less than they should, because some districts that are 50% low income are being counted as 80 or 90%. And that is it's making our highest poverty districts look richer and is distorting the school funding formula.
Now, one thing that the House budget talks about, and that was talked about at the press conference they had on it yesterday, is that members of the House think that school districts have too much money in their rainy day funds, and that that's a part of the problem. They want the money out of these rainy day funds. But the districts have this money because they don't know where their funding is coming from. They thought they were going to get the Fair School Funding Plan enacted, and now it's not. And the U.S. Department of Education is closing down, and they don't know if they're getting that money. So why are we picking on the rainy day funds whenever schools don't know where the money's coming from?
Well, districts should certainly have rainy day funds. The question is how much those dollars should be. How much should they be saving for that rainy day? According to that press conference yesterday, House leaders were suggesting that districts themselves have suggested having 25% in their rainy day funds. But there's a lot of districts that are sitting at 50 or 75% of those dollars. Well, at the same time we're trying to fund schools well and properly, as we should, you also have a lot of local property taxpayers who are saying, my goodness, my property taxes keep going up and up and up. And so what the House has proposed, and we'll see, you know, what happens during the legislative process, but what the House has proposed is to give some of that money back to local taxpayers if districts are sitting on huge amounts of dollars.
Now, a criticism leveled by many groups, including Policy Matters Ohio, who's our next guest, is that state lawmakers are working to defund and basically privatize public schools. Would you agree with that? Because there is a significant part of the budget that is going to vouchers.
Well, yes, I understand the question. No, I do not agree with it. Mm-hmm. When we're spending more money than we ever have on public education, more than $16,000 per student, it's a really heavy lift to suggest we're trying to defund them when we've never spent more. While the voucher numbers have increased, the actual funding amount that a student on a voucher gets in Ohio, if a high school student on the EdChoice program, gets a little over $8,000, whereas we fund on average $16,000 for a student in a traditional public school. So taxpayers are actually, total taxpayer support is far less for a student on a voucher.
90% of students go to public schools, though. So,
and they get more than 90% of the funding.
Right. So, but if the Republican lawmakers get more students to go to private schools, then it's less money going to public education.
But money goes to support students' education. What if everyone moved out of a district? Would the district still need $100 million? They wouldn't. Now, that will never happen. Traditional public schools are a cornerstone of Ohio and Ohio's education system, and they always will be. What you've seen in the voucher program is, and as you just said, 90% of kids still go to either a traditional public school or a community school, which are also public schools. That's the only way you get to the 90%. It's actually in traditional public schools that we're sitting at around 82% of students.
And the last thing I wanted to ask you, because before we got into talking about Governor DeWine's budget and the House budget, I wanted to talk about the federal U.S. Department of Education. How do you respond to criticism that eliminating the federal Department of Education is going to end up harming students and families in the long run? You know, it's not just about the money. It's the oversight. It's the data collection that we talked about in the first segment. There's things that Congress has enacted as a big job, and that's a lot to put on states to tackle. Like to have Ohio have to come up with all of this data now, that's a lot.
Yeah, it certainly is a lot. It will certainly signal big changes if Congress actually approves the elimination of the Department of Education. Of course, it does still require congressional approval, and we'll see what happens. Secretary McMahon is a smart executive. She has brought in really experienced deputy secretaries who have experience actually improving student outcomes in states. And so they've got a lot of experience on the ground. So she's put together a pretty stellar team. It will be interesting to see what happens. I'm guessing some responsibility, as we've talked about earlier, both with funding and oversight, will go back to the states. But there's certainly actually, one of the concerns I think that you've raised and you talked about in your first segment relates to the data. And I think it will be really important to continue having strong data systems at the federal government. So hopefully they don't back down from that role, because it really makes a difference in terms of knowing what's working and what isn't for students.
Yeah, it's going to be really hard to publish your report you do every year if you don't have that information, right?
That's right. Well, we got to make sure state data stays strong, mm-hmm. because it's really important to know, as I said, what's working and what isn't.
All right. Well, thank you for your time. That's Chad Aldis, Vice President for Ohio Policy for the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, a nonprofit conservative think tank. Thanks for joining us, Chad.
Thank you.
And coming up, we're going to drill down on the district level and talk about how changes at the U.S. Department of Education are impacting rural, urban, and suburban districts. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Ohio's public schools rely on $3 billion in federal funding every year. We're talking today about what closing the U.S. Department of Education could mean for future policymaking and whether Ohio can pick up the slack if federal money and data goes away. Policy Matters Ohio recently published a district-by-district breakdown of how much federal money flows to schools in the state. Hannah Halbert is the executive director of Policy Matters Ohio, a nonprofit progressive think tank based here in Ohio. Welcome to All Sides, Hannah.
Great to be here.
So, on your webpage, the first page shines a spotlight on school funding. It asserts that lawmakers are pushing to defund and privatize Ohio schools. Yesterday, the House unveiled its plan. What do you make of it as compared to what the governor's plan was in funding Ohio schools?
This plan is truly a step in the wrong direction. And it's particularly disheartening to see legislators abandon like half a century of progress toward adequate and constitutionally valid school funding here in Ohio. And that's what this plan does. It sets up this choice that folks have to make. Do you want to take a very nominal short-term gain of a little bit of an increase in the next biennium and toss out or abandon a school funding formula that is actually based on costs, that's created to provide some stability, some predictable funding for schools, and make sure that that's properly and fairly shared, that cost is shared between local communities and taxpayers and the state government. And the plan that we are seeing is a clear departure and abandonment of that approach. It's very disheartening.
Now, our last guest, Chad, from the Fordham Institute, said mm-hmm. that the state has never funded schools at a higher level. Like, this is the highest level. Is that true?
Well, I would have to check his number specifically, but my goodness, I would hope so. Mm-hmm. I hope that we are funding schools at the highest level, because we have been in the state underfunding schools for so long, to such a degree that was declared unconstitutional by our Supreme Court. It's taken since 1997 just to get to the point where we have two more years to fully implement a plan that will actually correct that. What we know is that if we actually look at the cost, so that's if you look at teacher and student ratios, how many teachers does a classroom and a school need, and what does that cost? How much paraprofessionals are needed to meet the needs of those students? What kind of extra and co-curricular activities and athletics are needed to meet the needs of the students? All of those elements have a price tag. The Fair School Funding Plan has 22 categories, each with additional subcategories of price. That's what this is based on. And according to that plan, that is based on cost, not some idea of progressive fantasy, but price tags. We are underfunding schools by the billions, and this house plan underfunds schools by nearly $2.75 billion over the biennium.
Now, the Fair School Funding Plan, this is the last 2 years of it, and the governor's proposal and the House, they're basically saying that all the districts' property taxes increased everywhere. So the districts all have, for the most part, the districts all have more property taxes, so therefore the state's share is supposed to go down because the property taxes went up.
So there's a difference between increased property valuations, which is what's included in the plan, and the actual money that school districts receive, first of all. And the balance works, and the way that the balance works is whenever the cost side of the equation also increases concurrently with those property valuations. And that's where the breakdown in Governor DeWine's plan happened, is that they allowed the property valuation component to be increased, to be brought current, but they didn't update the cost side, the expense side. And so it appears the districts are wealthier, that they're more capable of generating those funds for schools locally than they truly are. And what we see in the House is a complete abandonment of that plan. The idea that locals, who all we hear about is property tax reform and how desperately that's needed, can somehow increase the amount of money and their responsibility for students in these times is just not realistic. We have to fully implement the plan. That means updating costs and not just the side of the equation that makes it better for the state. And we have to include the increased dollars that are needed for kids with additional needs. So special ed, gifted students, VOTEC career, those components also have to be improved. That's what's going to make Ohio a place where kids, and any kid, regardless of your need, can go and get a high-quality education, an education that is they're entitled to under the Constitution.
Now, when I had the Ohio Education Association president, Scott DeMauro, on, he said that a big problem with the governor's plan and now the House plan is that they're using numbers for the cost to educate a child from 2022 instead of updating them to 2024. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that still hasn't happened in the House plan. But basically, House Speaker Matt Huffman said that that is unsustainable because if you use the 2024 numbers, it adds $1.8 billion to the budget that they don't have. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, Ohio's not broke. We have this money. This House plan includes a $600 million bond package to fund a billionaire's stadium. And that's just the price tag on that bond package. The full freight of that is going to be $1 billion in money. We have money to dole out to stadiums, to private schools, which the majority of those students were already attending those private schools. And recent data from the state shows that a lot of those families were higher income families that had no problem carrying the tuition of those schools. We have no problem with that. We give away vast amount of money in the form of tax loopholes, tax expenditures, things as silly as tax credits for keeping in deer, building pens to keep in deer. I mean, we spend money in this state on so many things that are absolutely unrelated to the health and quality of life for children. This is a constitutionally required duty of the legislature to act on. So whether it's $1 billion or $2 billion, that's the price of education. We have the money. We don't have legislators who will make the right choices to send that money to kids instead of to, well, in this case, billionaire football owners.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking about education policy at the state level in light of changes also at the federal level with the Department of Education, with Hannah Halbert, Executive Director of Policy Matters Ohio. We're going to debate the House budget for a while. It'll go to the Senate, you know. So can we pivot for just a few minutes to the federal level? Because there are concerns about what changes at the federal level could mean for 1 in 6 students who have a disability. you know, I want to talk also, you have district by district breakdowns, but can you expand on that, this idea of the funding from the federal level that goes to each district for students with disabilities?
Sure. So under the IDEA Act, the federal government sends a supplemental funding into school districts all over the country, all over here in Ohio, to support kids with additional needs. This is the sort of talk on this program is that it will be turned into some sort of block grant. It's unclear how that grant might be managed in state or at the federal system. It's unclear what kind of accountability or guardrails will be placed on that money, or how that money will be, how it will be protected, ensured that it will go to those kids with those needs. And IDEA right now, part of what is particular to this program and valuable from the current way this is structured is that there are protections in that in the law, in the statute, that this money has to support and look for ways to ensure that kids aren't being segregated or stigmatized based on their disability. So it also includes those kinds of guardrails and protection. And I think that those have a real big target on their back under this current administration.
So the ability to have a student with a disability be integrated into the classroom if they need an aid to fund that, to be with them and that kind
of thing. That's right. That's right.
So you made district by district fact sheets to show that how much federal funding is at risk. Now, this was all based on 2020 numbers, right? You know, because I guess that's what we have at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, whenever you're trying to get 600 plus districts together, sometimes your data source is limited. And that was the best source that we could find. Some of it's based on schools reporting into the database. So, yeah, it's not perfect, but I think it gives us a very good idea of the size of the risk for schools in Ohio.
So as an example, Columbus City Schools, the state's largest district, has about 45,000 students. They receive $51 million in Title I funds, and that was about 19% of their budget. So yeah, our last guest from the Fordham Institute said that he's not worried about the money still coming. It's just going to be come in a different way because the Federal Department of Education won't be necessarily managing it.
Yeah, and I think that should signal a big red flag for parents here in Ohio, and particularly parents who have kids in low-income areas of the state. Title I, we got to remember why Title I was created. This was a signature piece of legislation in the war on poverty. This money is directed and intended to support kids who live in poverty to have equal opportunity for high quality education. And we know before this happened, that wasn't happening. And if we take those protections off, there's a very good chance that that won't happen after. And Title I has been on the radar for elimination of certain really extreme conservative organizations since the get-go. But this is a way that we help kids who are in high poverty areas have a shot at economic mobility. The idea that we would just turn that into some sort of block grant, and by the way, block grants are really easy to cut in the future, very easy to cut. If we turn that into a block grant, no strings attached, we have no idea how that's going to be spent, how that is even going to be administered at the state level, and how there's going to be accountability, data generation for accountability or tracking. It should be something on every parent's radar and every parent who wants to make sure is concerned about economic mobility for kids.
Unfortunately, we have less than 2 minutes left, but I wanted to get into, just as an example, federal funds are about 8% of Dublin School's budget, 7% of Worthington. So in theory, it might be easier for a district like that to make up a smaller percentage. You know, it's under 10%. But like the highest I saw was Youngstown City Schools. The federal funds make up 43% of their budget. So a district like that, do you worry for them?
Absolutely. And I particularly worry for them in combination with the state plan that just rolled out. They're going to get hit hard. you know, we are getting calls from people in districts wanting us to help walk them through some of these fact sheets. Just yesterday, I got a call from a district up in northeastern Ohio that said they have 30% of their kids that are on IEPs. They are robbing Peter to pay Paul in their budget to make sure that those kids get what they need and what they are legally mandated to receive. The House plan offers them very little, and it certainly doesn't offer them a path to real sustainability to meet those needs and costs over time. Couple that with the sort of at best uncertainty and at worst chaos coming from the federal government, you gotta see that cannot be a way to functionally run a functional school system and really meet those needs of kids.
Well, we'll have to continue talking about this as the budget goes through. We'll have to see what happens at the federal level. But I want to say thank you, Hannah Halbert, Executive Director of Policy Matters Ohio, a nonprofit progressive think tank. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
And this has been All Sides with Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News.